With child at her young age, she jeopardized her future in medicine. The oldest of her parents' five daughters, she had been intended to show the way, acting as a beacon to the rest of them who might have had other ideas as to how they wished to spend their lives. All the girls were intended to be educated first, in possession of a career second, and married to suitable and equally educated husbands third. Everything else would follow from there, which meant a home, children, the trappings of success, and a list of accomplishments of which their parents could be proud. They believed Yasmina would fail at all this once she violated the sexual strictures that had been part of the fabric of her life, so she was cut off from them all. She had seen them only twice in the intervening years, once when she attempted to present them with their first granddaughter, and then again when she called upon them after attaining the goal of Doctor of Pediatric Medicine. In neither case had she been allowed into their house. She'd come to Coventry now because there were ghosts she had to lay at rest. Once Timothy had taken the drugs and gone to their bed, she'd climbed to the attic of the house. There she'd unearthed an old chest and removed from it the garments. She'd ironed these carefully, and then she'd donned them. She wore them now in Coventry. She'd chosen a sari of subdued hue from among those she'd kept for the important occasions that she'd hoped she would be invited to attend, such as the marriages of her sisters or the celebrations of births. Of course, she'd been invited to none of those, but still she had hoped that with time all would be forgiven and her family would welcome her back. Her sari was dark green, and she draped in the Nivi style. Her fingers had moved along the fabric by means of muscle memory, the pleats neatly tucked into the matching, firmly tied petticoat, the blouse adjusted above it, the gold-threaded palu positioned over her left shoulder. She wore sandals on her feet and gold bangles on her right wrist. Her left arm was cuffed in a band of gold, and she chose heavy earrings fashioned with green tourmalines. When she gazed upon her reflection, she saw what she wanted her parents to see. An Indian woman who had not forgotten her culture. Now she went to their door. The day was promising to be a warm one, and there on the sheltered porch of her parents' home she could feel the sun heating the back of her neck. She rang the bell. She had to ring twice before the door opened. Then her mother was standing before her, wearing a threadbare tracksuit and unlaced trainers. In the years since Yasmina had seen her, her mother's hair had thinned, and its colour had gone completely to grey. She squinted at Yasmina, and Yasmina thought the sunlight behind her was making it difficult for her mother to see her face. She took a step that would put her into the shade of the porch's gabled roof. She and her mother spoke at the same moment.
"Madur?" said her mother.
"Mum," said Yasmina. As if not hearing what Yasmina had said, her mother went on with,
"Madur, we have no cakes in the house. There is tea, but there's no milk, and the house itself, Mum, it's Yasmina."
"Who is Madur?" she thought.
"Would not be a matter of pride to me as it is just now. Have you come to speak about Rajni again? Mum, it's Yasmina, your eldest. Yasmina, will you let me into the house?"
"Oh, but I can't," her mother said.
"You must forgive me. Palash said I must not allow. And Rajni, did you not know she has long since married Madur? She is no longer available, although we do not see her. Palash did not approve the match, as you had not made it, and he was very angry at the disrespect this showed."
And then, on the thin edge of a coin, the subject changed to,
"Rajni, is it you who have come? But no, that cannot be. It would not be allowed. Rajni is heavy with a child now, unless you have lost the child. Rajni, have you lost the child? Did you forget to take him when you were last here? But you were not here, were you? Is it Bina who has come?"
Yasmina began to understand. She said,
"Is Palash here? Mummy, is Dad here?"
Because she could not imagine that her father might have left her mother alone as she was now.
"Rajni has done well," her mother said. "She is not what we intended for her, but her marriage. Ambika says it has brought her wealth. Ambika, though, has done less well, and I had such hopes for her. But something has gone wrong in her head, Palash says."
"What has happened to her?" Yasmina said.
"Mum, is Dad at home? Please let me in."
"Oh, so very sorry,"
her mother said, and began to close the door.
"Palash tells me I must not. Mummy!"
Yasmina pushed lightly against the panels to stop the door from closing altogether.
"Mother! Rajni, you must not! Ambika is not here. Palash says always, Mummy, let me in."
Her mother lacked the strength to keep her out, so Yasmina managed to get inside the place. But once inside, she wished she had remained on the porch. piles of newspapers, clumps of half-empty carrier bags, pictures dropped by cyclones on tabletops and floors, furniture stained, post unopened, magazines trampled underfoot, teacups and plates and glasses unwashed.
"Oh, you must not! You must not!" her mother cried. "Balash! Balash! Mother wants Rajni, and Ambika will hurt herself if you do not come! Balash!"
There was a pounding of footsteps above them. Then an equal pounding as a large figure in a dressing gown hurtled down the stairs. Yasmina's father was saying,
"Yes, yes, Vedas, Balash is here, but mother is dead. In India, Vedas. So long ago. You've only forgotten. Rajni and Ambika are gone, my dear. And who is this that you've opened the door to when I've told you?"
His words died off when he saw Yasmina clearly. And then it was only,
"You?"
Yasmina did not wait for any other reaction from him. She said,
"What's happened? Mummy, is... Dad, are you caring for her by yourself? How long..."
"Get out," he said. "This is what came of it all. Every one of them as if they were sheep and you the shepherd."
"Balash," her mother said. "Balash, when will Ambika come? And Sevti? Why do we not see Sevti? Did she not go to the market for us?"
He said to his wife,
"Vedas, you must rest your mind. Go into the kitchen and wait for me there."
"But should we not offer mother tea?"
"Yes, of course. Fill the kettle, Vedas. Just water in the kettle. Do nothing more."
She looked as if she were concentrating on this idea of water in the kettle. She murmured, "Water," to herself as she wandered off, stumbling against a pile of newspapers in the sitting room, distracted enough by this that she knelt in front of them and began to sort through them, making an arrangement whose purpose was clear only to her. Yasmina watched her with a sense of growing desperation. She said,
"What can I do? Tell me what I can do. Where are they?"
Her father's nostrils flared as if he smelled an unpleasant odour emanating from her. He said,
"Leave us. You are dead, and no spirit of any daughter of mine may enter this house."
Yasmina took in any and its larger implications. She said,
"You drove all of us away?"
"You did this," he said. "If they are dead to us, it is as you wanted it. You have driven a stake into my heart. You have destroyed your mother's mind, and this is what's left, what you see before you. Now leave us to our grief and our shame."
He turned her bodily, pushing her in the direction of the door. She grew stiff with resistance.
"It doesn't have to be this way. Why can't you see that?"
"Out!"
And now he raised both his voice and a fist. He advanced on her, as he had done in her past, and as, undoubtedly, he had done to her sisters. She backed away from him, but still said,
"Where are they? What has happened to my sisters? Where are they, Dad? Tell me."
"They are dead to us," he roared. "Begone with you and leave us in peace. Nothing has changed here, and nothing will."
Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, near Shelton, Shropshire. Barbara Havers had been sorry to miss the big moment. But when Linley had explained his plan to lead Ruddock into incriminating himself, she immediately recognized it as their best chance to sew up not only the death of Ian Druitt, but also the rape of Missa Lomax. When she'd heard him call her name as she waited with the patrol officers in the corridor of the Ludlow Nick, she knew he'd been successful. The rest of their encounter with the PCSO was form rather than substance. He'd been handcuffed, much as he'd handcuffed Ian Druitt. He'd been led to the patrol car. He'd been carted away at speed. She and Linley would next see him inside an interview room at the Shrewsbury station, but before that occurred, they had to deal with Clover Freeman. Linley rang Chief Constable Wyatt from the Nick's car park, with Barbara listening to his end of the call. After an interminable wait, and why did waiting for the CC seem to be de rigueur, for God's sake, Barbara wondered, Linley revealed only that he and Detective Sergeant Havers were about to leave Ludlow for West Mercia headquarters, where they would need to speak to the Deputy Chief Constable on the matter of Ian Druitt's death. If Wyatt could see to it that she didn't leave the premises. Linley listened for a moment to whatever Wyatt was saying to him, while Barbara waited like a horse at the starting gate. She was muttering, "Come on, come on," when Linley rang off, saying to her, "She's not gone into work."
"Christ, she's done a runner."
"I don't think so. She's rung in and told them she was going to Royal Shrewsbury Hospital to her son. She said her husband spent the night with him and she needed to spell him there."
"So you think... what? She's sitting there waiting for us to fetch her?"
"I think she's still in the dark about what's going on here. If we can get to her quickly, chances are we'll still find her that way. They set off at once. The distance wasn't great, but it had to be travelled on a road without a single dual carriageway, and twice they were significantly slowed by lorries. Without the benefit of lights or siren, they had to wait for opportunities to overtake the slower vehicles. Barbara found her anxiety growing by the moment, made worse by Linley's determined calm. She believed that Clover Freeman would have long ago destroyed the evidence handed over by Ruddock, if Ruddock had handed it over at all, which was still open to doubt. They would then be reduced to he said, she said, because both of them damn well knew that even if Ruddock had rolled his body all over the clothes they'd found beneath Brutus's bed, there would be DNA from everyone else on that clothing as well. Since at her own admission Ding had performed sex acts for Ruddock in order to keep him from taking her home, drunk, to her mother, Ruddock's DNA could be explained away using Ding's own behaviour with a PCSO to do it. Linley took a different position about the evidence. He pointed out to her that if they had learned nothing else about Clover Freeman, they had learned that she appeared to maintain control over her son in whatever way she could. Ruddock had been employed as a virtual spy on her behalf, and the boy had been tasked with engaging in a mother-approved form of social activism by volunteering at Ian Druitt's after-school club. As he grew older and more difficult for his mother to manage, she was going to need something very special to keep him within her sphere of influence. Evidence of an assault upon an unconscious girl worked quite a trick at doing that.
"That would mean she reckons he did it," Barbara said to Linley at the conclusion of his explanation.
Ruddock certainly went to every effort to convince her of that.
"So why not get rid of the evidence once she's got her mitts on it?"
"Keeping it gives her power." Linley eased the Healy Elliot into the right lane. He changed down gears and floored it, which allowed them to sail by a tractor and two cars. His own motor was ancient, but it had been built for speed. Barbara glanced at him as the trees along the verge became blurs of green. He looked quite satisfied with the car's performance.
"That's one bloody big risk, you ask me," Barbara said.
She was not referring to overtaking the other vehicles.
"It is, but she would have seen the payoff. I dare say she's told herself that everything she's done has been for Finn's own good. That would make her actions easier for her to swallow."
"Makes one wonder, though," Barbara said as she thought everything over. "I mean, aside from whatever Ruddock told her, she must have a reason for thinking Finn was the one who assaulted Miss Lomax."
"He appears to be doing everything he can to alienate her," Linley pointed out. "It's likely he's a decent sort at heart, but what he's done to his appearance alone suggests a form of rebellion that she wouldn't like. Doubtless there have been others over the years." At Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, Linley presented his warrant card at reception. A phone call brought a uniformed officer to speak with them. When Linley assured the man that he wished to speak to Finnegan's mother and not to Finnegan himself, the officer said,
"The dad's the only one here."
"We were told she's come to take over from Mr. Freeman," Linley said. "Did she not?"
"She was here for a bit, but then she left,"
the officer said.
"I suppose the dad didn't want to leave the boy."
"We'll need to speak to Mr. Freeman, then," Linley told him. "It's a matter of some urgency." The officer considered this one. He spent a moment sucking his teeth, as if with a desire to clean them of bits of breakfast. While he was doing his teeth-sucking, Linley added, "This will take less than 5 minutes."
"Right, it's only I'm not meant to let anyone into the room."
"We're happy with the corridor," Linley told him, to which Barbara added impatiently, "Or the rooftop, the car park, the inside of a lift, or standing next to a wheelie bin." The officer jerked his head to indicate they were meant to follow him. When they reached Finn Freeman's room, the door was closed. The officer told them to wait as he ducked inside. When he emerged, Trevor Freeman was with him. Freeman looked like a man whose life had been steamrolled. He said,
"You're not to talk to him. He's in and out of it. His memory's been affected, and unless—"
"We must talk to your wife, not your son," Linley cut in. "He's recovering, I hope."
"He will do, eventually. Do you have the bloody sod who did this?"
"We have a tentative identification made by someone who was in the house. The tool he apparently used has gone to forensics for fingerprinting as well. Mr. Freeman, we've been told that your wife was here briefly and then left. Have you any idea where she's gone?"
"She had a phone call," Freeman told them. "She said it was headquarters and stepped out of the room. I presume it was Wyatt asking her to come to Hindley."
"Why?" Barbara asked.
"Because she left. I mean, she didn't come back into the room."
Freeman looked from Barbara to Linley, his expression becoming wary.
"What's this about?"
"I know what's been going on, by the way, and let me be clear. My son did not rape anyone, and he did not sodomize anyone. He didn't even know that a girl was passed out in the house that night. Someone got inside the place because—"
"We know," Linley cut in. "An arrest has been made."
"Who?"
"I can't tell you more at the moment.
There are interviews to conduct and the victim and her family to be informed. We do need to speak to your wife first, however. Shall I ring her mobile? Or her office? Linley considered this. After a moment, he said no. Barbara knew that putting the wind up at this juncture was the very last step he would want to take. He would be seriously doubtful that Clover Freeman had actually been called to Hindlip, but he'd also be wanting to make sure of that without anyone's ringing her office or her mobile. He thanked Freeman. He wished him well. He said he hoped Finn would make a swift and complete recovery. He said that he would be in touch. Barbara followed him then as he retraced their route to the lift. She had a very bad feeling about what they'd learned. She was not surprised when, as they left the hospital, Linley put in a call to the Shrewsbury Nick and asked for the duty sergeant. For with its lights and siren, the patrol car carrying Ruddock would have made vastly better time from Ludlow to Shrewsbury than they had done, even with the Healy Elliot's speed and Linley's dexterity overtaking slower vehicles. Upon being booked, Gary Ruddock would have requested and been granted the phone call owed to him. There was little doubt he would have made that call to Clover Freeman, who, from the hospital, was mere minutes from the station.
"She's going for the evidence," Barbara said, as Linley waited to be put through to the duty sergeant. "She has to be, sir. She needs to get rid of it."
"That's one scenario," Linley agreed.
"There's another?"
He didn't have a chance to reply as he began speaking, presumably to the duty sergeant. Had Gary Ruddock been brought to the station? Yes, he had. Had he been booked? Yes, he had. Had he asked for a phone call? Yes, he had. Linley listened to what Barbara thought was an answer lengthier than was required. At the end of this, Linley said, "Has anyone asked to see him?" "Yes, someone had." Again he listened. Barbara wanted to rip the mobile from his ear or shout to put it on speaker, but she had to wait. Linley thanked the man and ended the call. He said to her, "She's been there."
"Did they actually let her see him?"
It's not likely that a duty sergeant would refuse the deputy chief constable's request for a word with the bloke just brought in on charges.
"He did make his phone call to her, then?"
The sergeant didn't have it verbatim for me, but Ruddock evidently said to whomever he rang that he'd been arrested, and they needed to talk. The sergeant reckoned he was ringing his solicitor, but I think you and I can rely upon that constituting Gary Ruddock's message to the DCC that she was to come at once. Once she arrived and asked to see him, I think we can assume he told her everything, with a few careful lapses in the information.
"But he wouldn't have said he's the one who assaulted Miss Lomax, would he?"
"I dare say he'd have wanted to keep her believing Finn did it. If he told her we're closing in on Finn, she'll get rid of the evidence. She might have kept it in order to keep the boy under her thumb. But with him now in the spotlight as a suspect in the assault of Miss Lomax, she'd want to be rid of it as soon as she could manage it."
"She can't risk dumping it anywhere near her home," Barbara said. "She'll know we'll search every dustbin, skip and wheelie bin in Worcester if we have to."
"She certainly can't risk dumping it at work," Linley pointed out. "For the very same reason. So where does that leave us?" Barbara thought of the potential locations. They knew very little about the DCC. If she'd been carrying the evidence round in her car all these months, she could easily dump it anywhere. She could toss it onto a verge. She could fire up her barbecue and burn it. She could find a superstore and slip it into a wheelie bin there. She could take a flight to Timbuktu, for all they knew, and there she could—
"The airfield, sir," Barbara said. "She's a member of that glider club, along with Rabia Lomax and Nancy Scannell. Remember the photo? If she uses a glider, she can easily get to a reservoir, or to the middle of a moor, or to just about anywhere. She can dump the evidence as long as the place is remote enough or inaccessible enough, no one will find it."
"Where is this airfield?" Linley asked.
"On the high moors above Church Stretton, middle of nowhere. Me and the Gov talked to Nancy Scannell there."
"Can you find it again?"
"I can bloody well try. It's on the Long Mynd."
"Do you know the name of the airfield itself?" Barbara searched for it in her memory. It had to do with the Midlands. She recalled that much. Then it came to her.
"West Midlands Gliding Club," she told them.
"Ring them, then. Tell them to stop her if she wants to take out the glider." Barbara snapped her fingers. Good cheer descending upon her as she recalled a delightful, vital fact.
"The consortium's glider is damaged," she said. "That's what was going on at Rabia Lomax's house when we arrived to speak to her. Remember? A meeting about the damaged glider. Clover Freeman may not know that that glider's going nowhere, no matter what she wants."
"They may well have extra gliders available for individuals who don't have the funds to purchase their own, or for people wanting lessons, or for people wanting to go out for a lark in the company of an experienced pilot. If that's the case, if there are spare gliders, we must stop her from using one, so make the call, Sergeant.
Then get us to the gliding club as quickly as you can.
Ironbridge, Shropshire. When Yasmina arrived home, she found that Timothy was not only awake, but also climbing the slope towards their house on New Road, ascending from Wharfage. She pulled alongside him and lowered the passenger window, asking, "Would you like a ride the rest of the way?" He looked towards her but shook his head. He gestured for her to go on, which was what she did. She was able to park in their garage for once, and when she got out and came round to the front door, she saw that he was two houses away, so she waited. If he was surprised to see how she was clad, he made no mention of the ethnic clothing. He merely went into the house, leaving the door open for her to follow. She saw him pass through the entry, and from there he made his way to the kitchen. She herself climbed the stairs. In the bedroom she removed the sari and its accompanying garments. She folded them neatly for their return to the attic. Then she dressed as she would normally. When she descended to the kitchen, she found him making a sandwich. He glanced round as she came into the room, saying, "Do you want something? Making two is as easy as making one. It's going to be cheese, pickle, onion and tomato. I started to walk to the market, but, I don't know, it seemed out of reach." She said that she would be grateful for a sandwich. He made it in silence. She wanted to ask him what it was that had managed to get him out of bed, but she held her peace. Instead, she put water in the kettle and set it to boil. She got out the tea, Earl Grey for him, Darjeeling for her, along with two person-sized pots. She let hot water run into these to warm them as she made tea sachets for them both. He finally said, "It was Mum. She rang one of the neighbours."
"What do you mean?"
"Mum rang here. I don't know, 3 or 4 times. It didn't wake me. So when I didn't answer and you didn't answer, she rang the clinic. I expect at that point she panicked, as much as Mum ever panics. So she rang old Reg Douglas from the end of the street, and he came to see if... Well, at any rate, he got me up. I was to phone her," he said.
"Has something happened to me, sir?"
Yasmina asked quickly. Reg couldn't say anything about anything since he didn't know, but seeing as Mum had been ringing the neighbours... Timothy waved the knife he'd been using to spread the pickle. "He got me up." He glanced at her then. "I couldn't work out where you were. Once I rang the clinic, I mean. You didn't go to work."
"Timothy, what did Rabia want? Why did she phone the neighbours?"
"Police liaison came by to tell her there's been an arrest." Yasmina was almost afraid to ask, but she knew she had to, so she said,
"Of whom? For what?"
"For what happened to Missa."
"Did one of those boys?"
"It was someone else. Rabia told me she asked who it was, but the liaison officer wouldn't say. His remit was to tell her that an arrest had been made and the bloke was being taken to Shrewsbury. No worries that he might show up to do Missa any more harm." The kettle clicked off. Yasmina went through the tea-making by rote as Timothy cut the sandwiches in halves and then in quarters. He carried them to the table on a single plate, fetching two smaller sandwich plates as if he and Yasmina were engaging in a ritualized afternoon tea. She went along with this, removing teacups and their saucers from a cupboard, fetching napkins, milk, and sugar. They sat at the table and said nothing for a moment until Yasmina told him where she had been. "The sari," he noted.
"I thought it would help."
"It didn't, I assume." He poured her some tea, then did the same for himself. He took a quarter of a sandwich. She did the same. She said,
"I thought it might soften them towards me. But Mummy was only confused by it, and I don't think my father even noticed. All of them are gone now. It was the same for them."
"Your sisters?"
"All of them."
"Not pregnant, though. I can't think any of them would have made that mistake after what happened to you."
"That I don't know," she said. "Just that he's cut them off, and there he and Mummy are completely alone. Their house. It's like something one sees in a film, Timothy. It seems like they've become hoarders."
He stared at his sandwich for what seemed like 2 minutes, but was probably less than 30 seconds. He raised his head and looked at her just as long before he said,
"I'm very sorry. That must have been a blow to you, yes?
Where are your sisters?
What became of them?" "I don't know. I must begin a search."
She picked up her own sandwich, but her throat was too dry because of what she knew she needed to say. She placed the sandwich onto her small plate and took a sip of her tea and then another. She said,
"You were right about everything."
"I haven't been right about anything in years."
"That's not true. Regarding the girls, you were right from the first."
She tried to find the words to explain what it had meant to see her parents, to learn how life had unfolded for them and for her sisters. She said,
"Timothy, seeing them, understanding for the first time, I don't know if I could possibly describe it to you."
"No need. I've still got enough imagination left to work it out."
"What I want to say."
At her hesitation, he looked at her and his expression altered, and she wondered what it was that she was meant to read on his face. Compassion, hope, worry, or merely resignation that all was lost. She forged ahead with,
"I want you to know that this, who I would like to be instead of who I've been, this will be a struggle for the rest of my life."
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"I intend to do whatever it is I need to do to become someone I can live with and someone you and the girls can live with. That's what I mean. I also mean that I am so profoundly sorry for where I've taken us as a family."
"It's not all down to you."
"Part of it is, and that's the part I can barely stand to think about, let alone to see."
She waited, although she wasn't sure for what. Indeed, she wasn't sure she ought to be waiting at all. Wasn't the truth that she could only own the actions she herself had taken, the decisions she herself had made, and the blinkers she herself had worn? Timothy would have to do whatever he needed or wanted to do on his own. He said, "Rabia's bringing her home. That was part of why she rang. Missus asked her to bring her here."
"To Ironbridge, you mean?"
"I mean here."
"Home. Here."
Yasmina took this in and turned it round in her mind, finally saying,
"I don't exactly know how I feel about that. Frightened, I think. What does it mean that I'm frightened to see my own daughter?"
When Timothy didn't reply, Yasmina said,
"She'll want something from me, and I don't know if I have inside of me what she needs."
"I expect you'll need to ask her first if she wants anything at all," he said. "I expect both of us must ask her that." The Long Mynd, Shropshire. Havers kept ringing the gliding club once she had its phone number in hand. She kept saying that it was
a bloody recording, and then, "Doesn't anyone actually work in the sodding place? There's meant to be a receptionist. There was an office. The governor, I saw it. So where is this person?"
"Keep ringing," Linley told her. They were making decent time in their rush to the Long Mynd, but Clover Freeman had a very good start on them. Brief as her conversation with Gary Ruddock would have been, she would have known at its conclusion that she stood in every kind of danger. She'd orchestrated the deacon's death. She'd withheld evidence. She'd obstructed not only an IPCC investigation, but also two additional investigations made by the Metropolitan Police. She was going to be occupying a cell at the monarch's pleasure for a very long time, unless she could manage to rid herself of the evidence she was holding, which, she believed, marked her son as sexual predator. Aside from phone calls to and from Gary Ruddock made to her husband's mobile, they really had nothing on the woman save an argument that a 19-day wait to arrest the deacon existed in the first place because Ruddock, and not a regular patrol officer, had to be the one putting the handcuffs on Ian Druitt. But if she had in her possession the garments that Mr. Lomax had handed over to Druitt, she would find it very difficult to explain them away in a court of law, and she had to have those garments with her. She was astute enough to understand that the walls were closing in. Doubtless she'd kept the clothing nearby from the moment Ruddock had handed it over. The underthings were not only a crucial element in the investigation, they also served a greater purpose in her malignant relationship with her son. They swept south on the A49, passing neatly planted fields of summer wheat. They had better luck with the traffic this time, and with a distance that was shorter than their earlier drive from Ludlow, they were swerving into a right turn on one of Shropshire's lesser roads in quarter of an hour. The village of All Stretton passed as a blur, and they were fast coming upon the larger town, Church Stretton, when Havers cried, "Here, sir! Here!" Linley nearly missed the turn, so thick were the trees and so narrow was the lane onto which Havers directed him. It quickly became a single car's width, and when the sergeant said, "Ouch! Sorry, sir!" Linley knew she was referring to the Healy Elliot. He wasn't reassured when she said, "It's going to get worse in a second or two," which it did. She said, "Here! Other side of that coal box," when they reached a few farm buildings that went for the hamlet of Asterton. He saw that just beyond the red BT booth to their right, a track began to climb a hillside so steep that he wasn't certain his lowest gear could actually manage it. He changed down gears. A plump ewe toddled onto the road. A lamb behind her. He hit the brakes with a curse. Havers said, "There'll be ducks as well. I'll see to it.
and she got out of the car. She shooed the ewe and its offspring to the far edge of the road, giving Linley what looked like 6 inches of leeway to pass the animals. In the car again, Havers continued ringing the glider club. She finally managed to get through to someone. She identified herself. She said she was on her way. She asked about Clover Freeman. She listened for a moment before she said into her mobile, "Can't you bloody well look for her?" "What do you mean? You obviously haven't been sitting there in reception, because I've been ringing and ringing and there's been no one." Linley glanced at her. She was becoming quite red in the face as she listened to whatever she was being told. She finally said, "You listen to me, you sodding fool. This is..." "Sergeant," Linley murmured, "a murder investigation, and that woman's in the middle of it, and what you're doing at this precise moment comes down to..." "All right. Do it now." She punched her mobile to disconnect and said to Linley, "He's told someone to do a search for her." "How large is the place?" "Various wartime huts used as hangars, as well as outbuildings, barns, and a whole bloody caravan site." She cursed and then said quickly, "Turn here, sir. This is the last bit." Linley was glad of that, as the last part of the route was down to mere tracks for vehicles' tyres. They were high on the open moor now, a vast and treeless expanse of land coloured at this time of year by the gorse, whose yellow blooms were interrupted by lacy bursts of bracken green in the spring and large swaths of heather that would turn the moor purple later in the summer. It was clear why the Long Mynd was a desired site for launching gliders. To the west, Shropshire gave way to rolling hills, some comprising quartzite and some consisting of volcanic debris. The landscape rose once to form the mass of rock that was the Stipperstones, but other than that it merely undulated. One could sail in the sky straight into Wales if the air currents allowed it. Havers cried out, "Here, sir, on the right!" at the same moment as Linley saw the sign and then the gate of the airfield. He had barely braked the Healy Elliot before Havers was out of the car, shoving the gate open and hopping back in to point the way to the main building, set back from a gravel-strewn area that served as car park. Opposite this, at a distance of some 300 yards, Havers pointed out the launching site for the gliders. 2 were queued up, ready to take to the air. A third forward one was balanced with someone holding its wingtip while an individual with a clipboard walked round it, engaging in what appeared to be a pre-flight inspection. Havers said, "Should I?" and waved towards the launching area. Linley said, "Go ahead, I'll check inside." And he set off towards the main building while Havers headed in the direction of the queue of gliders. Once inside, he found the reception office. He learned to his chagrin that Clover Freeman had not been located at the airfield. No glider had been taken out in her name, no cursory search of the club's buildings had produced her. No response to announcements made on the internal and external public address systems had turned up either her or anyone who had seen her. Linley cursed, quietly. It had seemed so probable. They knew she was a glider pilot. They knew she belonged to a consortium of other pilots. They knew this location was the only one in Shropshire from which the consortium members might... Members, he realized. He asked if Nancy Scannell was at the airfield, if Nancy Scannell had checked out one of the gliders they had for hire. The receptionist, a swarthy gentleman whose badge identified him as Kingsley and who looked as if he'd spent his formative years walking the Shropshire hills in the blazing sun, had a look both on the sign-in sheet and then through the forms apparently filled out for taking a glider out for a flight. He shook his head. No Nancy Scannell. "Sorry," he said. Fact was, the only glider hired out at the moment had been hired by someone called Lomax. He couldn't quite read the scrawl, but it looked like... Rachel, possibly? "Rabia Lomax?" Linley asked, and before the man could reply, he went on with, "Has she launched? Can you stop her?" Kingsley said the best he could do was radio the winch operator. He said, "So you're not wanting the Clover Freeman?" "That is Clover Freeman," Linley replied. "Radio the operator. Tell him I'm on my way." Linley set off at a jog. In the distance, he could see Havers hurrying towards the 2 remaining gliders. The earlier one had already been launched. It soared in the distance, circling now to head in the direction of Wales. The next was being checked over, its pilot already in the cockpit. Havers was steaming towards it. But the glider was not important now. They had to stop the winch. He rang Havers's mobile, then saw his error when Havers paused to dig for it. He cursed and cut off the call. She stopped her search but looked in the direction from which he was now running. That made things worse, as she hesitated. He waved her on. He shouted. If Clover Freeman was ready to launch, she still could not do it without the aid of the winch operator. Havers would know that. Surely she would know that.
She was meant to stop the operator from whatever mechanism he employed to assist in a launch. She was not meant to stop Clover Freeman herself. She misread his intent and kept on her path to the gliders. It was down to Kingsley in the reception office. His ability not only to radio the winch operator, but to radio the correct winch operator, as there were two of them, one at each end of the grassy runway. Havers ran to the glider still in the queue. She banged on the cockpit's plexiglass cover. It lifted. She spoke. She turned to dash to the forward glider. At that moment, the closer winch flashed its lights at the distant winch. The glider began to move. Havers reached it. A horn of some kind began to shriek. She flung herself at the cockpit as if to open it. She managed to grab onto the edge of the plexiglass in some way, but she was not in time to do anything else. The glider rolled forward, and then it was too late. Havers fell. The glider lifted off the ground as the distant winch drew it forward at speed. Aerodynamics did the rest. It launched within seconds. It climbed steeply. It would, Linley knew, disengage from the winch as soon as it disengaged. But it did so at what looked like only 500 feet, not enough lift, not enough altitude. It plunged to the ground. Linley heard the cries coming from all directions. Those in the car park watching the launch began running towards the crash. Havers had scrambled to her feet. She tore towards the glider as the winch operator leapt from his vehicle, shouting, "She released! She released!" The pilot in the waiting glider climbed out and ran forward, hand over mouth. Others nearby dashed to the downed plane while a horn blared from the distant winch, perhaps alerting those inside the main building to the unfolding disaster outside. Linley made it to the glider at the same moment as Havers. Someone from the car park had reached it first. What remained of the cockpit cover had been removed, and the pilot had fallen half out of the straps that had restrained her. Voices came from every direction as more people arrived at a run.
"Who did the fucking rig check?"
someone demanded, as someone else declared.
"I checked every fucking inch. There was nothing. Is she all right? Jesus, Franklin, what do you think?
It's got to be the cable release.
I checked. I checked. That woman ran out of nowhere, and all of a sudden, get her out of there. Don't touch her. She could be...
Oh, too fucking bloody right, Steve."
"What woman? Where is she? Don't you understand? She released it herself. There was nothing wrong.
Why the hell would she release at that altitude?
She might not have known what would...
Who is she?
Is this her first solo? Didn't he stop the launch?
I radioed.
Oh, God, he was told...
The police are here somewhere. There they are. They wanted the police?"
Which brought about a stuttering into silence as every gaze sought out someone to name as the party responsible for what had occurred, and the police were going to be as good as any.
"She released the glider from the cable too soon, sir," Havers said. "I'm so bloody sorry. I thought I could stop her. But when she saw me..."
"She knew it was over," Linley said. "She knew what came next, Barbara." Ironbridge, Shropshire. Rabia thought at first that she would stop and fetch Sati, but when she reflected upon everything, she decided that bringing the little girl back sooner rather than later, while undoubtedly reassuring to her, would be an impediment to what needed to pass between Missa and her parents. So she went directly to Timothy's home, telling Missa that Justin would bring Sati down from the Goodales residence once she gave him the word to do so. He knew, she told Missa, that she was bringing Missa back to Ironbridge. He wanted Missa to know he was that worried, she continued. He wanted her to know he'd already been to speak to Yasmina. He wanted to learn what was happening because he was meant to tell Sati something, and had they not agreed that whatever else went on, they would never lie to themselves, to each other, or to Missa's little sister. Missa took this all in, but made no reply other than, "Thank you, Gran, for not telling him." Rabia said to her, "Why would I tell him? What must you think of your grandmother, even to consider the idea? It's only that if he knew about it all, I mean, I can see how you would think he might not want to marry me then." "I would think that? How absurd. Mum, then, equally absurd. If we know nothing else about life in general, and our family in particular, we do know that Justin is devoted to you, has always been, will always be. And this includes your mother, Missa. Despite what you might think of everything she's done regarding you, Justin, your marriage, university, and God knows what else, his love for you has never been in question. Perhaps in your own eyes, never in ours." Rabia could tell that Missa took this in and thought about it during their drive from Ludlow. That had always been one of her strongest characteristics, as well as one of her weakest. She considered what other people thought, even when she should entirely dismiss what other people thought.
Knowing her daughter-in-law as she did, Rabia expected Yasmina to come dashing from the house the moment she and Missa arrived. She reckoned Yasmina would have been watching from a window. Indeed, she thought she caught a glimpse of her as she pulled up in front of the house. But she did not come out, and when Rabia rang the bell, it was Timothy who answered the door. He took Missa into his arms. For a moment Missa stood statue-like, but then she returned the embrace. Arm round her shoulder, Timothy led her inside. He said, "Thanks, Mum," and Rabia followed them. Yasmina was in the sitting room, closer to the kitchen than she was to the entry. She held out a hand towards Missa, but she dropped it quickly, as if determined not to give the wrong impression. Unsurprisingly, knowing the child as Rabia did, Missa said, "I'm sorry for the trouble I've caused," which was enough to move Yasmina forward, although she still seemed hesitant. She said, "Not one thing in all of this can be laid at your feet. I want you to see that." Missa made no reply to this. She seemed confused by her mother's words. She looked first to her father, then to Rabia. There was silence then. Into it, Rabia's mobile rang. She frowned at the number, which she did not recognize. She answered with a quiet, "What is it?" and heard the voice of the Scotland Yard detective speaking about the assault upon Missa, the arrest of Ludlow's PCSO for the crime, and the death of Clover Freeman, who was one of the PCSO's superior officers. Although she had questions aplenty, she did not ask Inspector Linley. She merely said, "Thank you. I've brought Missa to Ironbridge. Do you need her?" He said he didn't think so, at least not just yet, but he would be in touch. Everyone's gaze was upon her as Rabia returned her mobile to her bag. She said to Missa, "The police community support officer in Ludlow has been arrested by the Met detectives. He was the one, my dear." She did not look at Timothy as she spoke. Whatever he had done on the previous day, they would have to deal with it later. He did drop his arm from Missa's shoulder at that, though. He walked to the sofa, and there he sat, his hands dangling limply between his legs. Missa said to her grandmother, "The night it happened, when I was drunk, he was who took us home. But he left, Gran. I thought he'd gone to fetch Ding. She'd made him so angry. She wouldn't do what he said. I thought when she ran, he went after her. Perhaps he did, but I don't expect he found her. He came back at some point and entered the house. I shouldn't have even been there. I shouldn't have been drunk." Yasmina said, "You've just laid this at your own feet, Missa. Do not do that. I knew better, Mum. What you knew was that your exams were completed, and you were meant to have a nice evening." Missa lowered her head. It was as if she couldn't take in, let alone accept, what her mother was trying to tell her. Yasmina closed the distance between them. "Missa, can you bear to look at your mum? If you can't, looking at me is not required, but I hope you'll listen." She didn't wait for a sign from her daughter before she continued. "I wish to hand you your life with an open heart. I do so want to do that. I ask only one thing in return, if you can manage it, that you forgive me one day. Not now. I don't even want that now, because if you give forgiveness now, it will be given because you think you're meant to please me, when in the deepest part of your heart you know that you aren't, which is what you've tried to tell me for so long. The sins I committed against you, Missa, were committed out of love, and I hope you will see that some day. But make no mistake, because I make none when I say this to you. The things I did and said and wanted and insisted upon, they were sins all the same. Mum, I never meant faced with the mummy you've had for all of your life," Yasmina said. "Believe me, Missa, you did what you needed to do."
Yasmina held out her hands to Missa. Rabia silently urged the girl to take them, to make just one move to let her mother know that something of what they'd never had as mother and daughter might be constructed between them now. She did not do so. Instead, she said, "Can I ring Justy?"
Yasmina lowered her hands, but her expression remained open, willing and loving. She said,
"Justin will be relieved if you ring him. Ask him to come for you if you would like that."
Still, Missa looked as if she needed more permission. She glanced at her father. He nodded. She glanced at Rabia, who said,
"He's that anxious for your call, Missa. Shall I ask him to fetch Sati home, then, Gran?"
Yasmina was the one to reply,
"Only if Sati wishes to come."
Missa left them then. Rabia waited till she heard her footsteps on the stairs, and
After a moment, her bedroom door closed. She herself said nothing to her son and his wife. She merely waited for what needed to be said, and she prayed that there was enough courage left in the family for the words to be given voice. Timothy rose from the sofa. He said to her, "I expect one of them gave you a card when they spoke to you?"
"The woman did," Rabia said. "The detective sergeant."
He nodded and held out his hand. "I'll ring her then."
"When they asked for the photo, there was nothing I could—"
"That's down to me, Mum," Timothy said. "It's time I got myself sorted, wouldn't you say? Whatever steps meant to be taken now, I'm the one meant to be taking it." Worcester, Herefordshire. Once the Met Police left Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, Trevor had rung Clover's mobile again and again, with the same result. He'd also been ringing Gaz Ruddock, but there was no joy to be had doing that, either. He'd kept all of this from Finn. After the London detectives had put in their appearance at the door to his son's room, Trevor had determined to remain with Finn until he could work out not only what was happening, but also that the boy was safe in every way, one of which was safe from being interviewed. As the hours had passed, though, it became progressively more difficult for him to remain calm. Something was happening, or surely Clover would have rung him to reply to his many calls to her. That she hadn't done so thrust Trevor into a morass of terrifying suppositions. When his mobile finally rang late in the evening, he grabbed it up and headed for the doorway to the corridor. Finn was dozing, and he wanted nothing to awaken the boy. His caller turned out to be the same London detective who'd come to the hospital in search of Clover. He asked Trevor's whereabouts first, and then requested a meeting with him in Worcester. To Trevor's reply that he was still in Shrewsbury with Finn, the man said that their encounter needed to be in Worcester, at his home. "Was there still an officer in the corridor outside Finnegan's door?" the man inquired. To Trevor's affirmative reply, the detective then pointed out that Finn would be safe.
"I've not been able to reach Clover," Trevor told him.
That was, Inspector Linley told him, the reason he wished to speak to him in Worcester. He himself was, along with his sergeant, at police headquarters in Hindlip. They'd just finished up a meeting with the chief constable. DCC Freeman had not been at headquarters, by the way. As things had developed, she'd gone from Shrewsbury to the Long Mynd.
"What the devil?" Trevor said. "Are you saying she went gliding?"
Linley, however, wasn't saying anything other than to express his intention of speaking further to Trevor in Worcester. When could Mr. Freeman manage to get there? He asked politely. So there was little choice if Trevor wanted more information. The two London officers were waiting for him when he arrived. They were in a car that looked nothing at all like something any police officer ought to be driving. He might have remarked upon the vintage motor had not he at once clocked the expression on the officers' faces. He turned his head away, trying to ward off what was to come. He led them to the front door and inside the house. He switched on lights in the entry. He did the same in the sitting room. He went to the cabinet in which they kept spirits. He opened it, stared at its contents, and wondered what he would imbibe that might obliterate the reality he was about to face. They waited, the Met detectives. When he turned from the cabinet, they were both watching him with a gravity he would not be able to dispel with a drink, with questions, with a report about Finn's progress, with anything. So he said, because he knew what was coming.
"How?"
"Her glider crashed almost at once when it was launched," Linley said.
"Someone did something to it?" "She released it too soon from the launching cable," Havers said. "She'd seen me, Mr. Freeman. She understood why we were there."
"I'm very sorry," this from Linley.
"Was she—"
"She lived briefly after the crash, but not long enough to speak. Would you like to sit down?"
"Finn, I must—"
He was suddenly angry.
"This is why I had to come home? You couldn't be bothered to come to Shrewsbury to tell me so I wouldn't have to leave my son alone? It was so sodding important that—" "Why? What are you saying about my wife?"
They seemed to be willing to give him a moment, and he took it. He needed to do so because the walls shimmered and the spots where their family photos were hanging suddenly went to black in his vision. One of the two officers took his arm. When he regained his sight, he saw it was Linley, who urged him to sit. The London detective began speaking then. Trevor had no choice but to listen. He tried to tell himself that everything had been unknown to him, but wasn't the truth that early on he'd known, without wanting to ask directly? They spared him nothing. When Linley paused, the woman Havers continued,
so by the end of the recitation he knew what Gaz Ruddock had done to the girl inside Finn's house in December, what he'd managed to persuade Clover into believing about the crime, how this related to the unfortunate Ian Druitt, and to vital evidence, and to an orchestrated arrest, and an orchestrated suicide, and all of it done because Clover Freeman could not believe that her son might have been not only innocent, but also ignorant of the crime that had occurred on a night when he and his mates were drunk. When they laid out for him what he thought was every possible horror, they ended with what he did not expect. "We've searched the glider and the vehicle she took to the airfield," Lindley said. "We've had a team going through all the buildings up there as well. C.C. Wyatt gave us access to her office, and we've done a search there. This, the house here, is our last hope of finding what we've been looking for." He hadn't been married to Clover for more than 20 years to miss the detective's intention. He said, "Why the hell would she keep evidence here? That doesn't make sense if she believed Finn." But then he saw that, to Clover, it would have made perfect sense if she believed Finn had assaulted the girl. "With your permission, we'd like to have a look round," Lindley said. It took them more than 3 hours. Trevor wouldn't have thought it possible for a search of the premises to require that much time, but they were as meticulous as they were thorough. They found what they were looking for, at long last, in the attic. Clover had kept the girl's tights and underwear in the evidence bag into which they'd been placed by Ruddock. She'd buried them in a cardboard box, among Finn's baby clothes. The irony of her choice was not lost on Trevor. He said dully, "We'd always hoped." But there was no point in completing the thought. So instead he said to the officers, "How can you use this? Now, I mean?" Lindley seemed to understand the implication, because his reply was, "The chain of evidence is destroyed, of course. Your wife and Ruddock both saw to that. But the DNA on here will, we believe, put a full stop to the matter, especially when it comes to your son." Havers added with a gesture towards the bag, "Once he knows we have this, with his DNA and not Finn's on it, Ruddock will have something of a job explaining things, especially as the girl in question isn't one he ever had anything to do with before that night. She'd never even been drunk, so she'd never been carted off by him, so she'd never been one of the girls who let him into her knickers to avoid being taken home to her parents. Under other circumstances, he could have used that to excuse the DNA, you see." "Are you saying Ruddock didn't know the girl he assaulted?"
"Yes," Lindley said. "That's what we think."
Havers put in, "He was dead cheesed off at Ding Donaldson, see? He went back to the house later, saw a girl on the sitting-room sofa, and since it was so dark, he either thought it was Ding, and he meant to punish her for running off, or he didn't care one way or the other who he did it to, as long as he did it to someone."
Trevor took this in. He knew he ought to be experiencing something at this point. Anything, really. But all of it was simply too much. He could barely feel his limbs when he moved, let alone feel his emotions. He said, "I don't know how I'll tell Finn. Am I meant to say that right to her death, his mum intended to have some kind of power over him? Right to her death, she saw him as a rapist?"
Lindley seemed to consider the possibilities before he replied with, "You might tell him she was human, as we all are. You might say that she believed something false that she was told by the PCSO, and from that mistaken judgment on her part, everything else came."
"Why would she believe Gaz Ruddock, and not her own son?" Trevor asked.
He directed the question to himself, really, and he went on to give himself the answer as well.
"She was afraid to ask him directly, wasn't she? She could tell at that point he wasn't about to be the person she wanted him to be, and since she didn't know who he was in the first place, it was easy enough for Gaz Ruddock to tell her. Christ! Christ!"
Trevor's voice broke.
"Will you be all right here by yourself, Mr. Freeman?"
The woman, Havers, was the one to ask this. He got himself together so that he could answer and then act. He said,
"I won't be alone. I'm going back to the hospital to be with Finn."
Ironbridge, Shropshire. Yasmina was grateful that her mother-in-law remained. Once Timothy had made the phone call to the Scotland Yard detectives, once he'd been told that a patrol car would be sent to fetch him, once that car had come and he'd been taken, Rabia's iron self-control had deserted her. Ages of grief had poured out of the woman, Every why she had never voiced demanded a reply that Yasmina could not give her. Sati and Justin had not arrived till after Timothy had been taken, so there was a small blessing in that, as Sati did not have to watch her father being arrested. As it was, she came into the house tentatively enough, as if fearing the worst from every quarter, and Yasmina's heart grew sore when she saw the child's expression and her reflexive step to hide behind Justin. As for Justin, he'd entered in a state that said he was more than ready to know exactly what was occurring in the Lomax family. He'd said, "It's time you lot made a few things clear," in a tone that declared he'd had enough of them all. Yasmina couldn't blame him, but she said nothing, and at that point Rabia was not present. Missa was, though, and she said, "It's down to me, Justy. Can we go for a walk?" That left Yasmina with Sati, the two of them watching each other across a chasm that only one of them was meant to breach. Yasmina said to her, "I have failed you, Sati, but from this day no more." Sati watched her, not quite comprehending. Yasmina could see her confusion in her lovely eyes and how they moved in her face, directing her gaze towards avenues of escape. She, Yasmina, had bought and paid for this reaction. She said to her, "Sati, listen to me. I want to hand your life to you." Sati drew in on her lower lip. "I hit you." Yasmina stopped herself. "No, that isn't what I did. I punched you in anger. It happened in an instant, and I have to tell you that I meant to do it. In that moment, I wanted to hurt you. I thought if I did, that you would see... I don't even know now what I thought you would see. That I'm right? That you're wrong? Who knows any longer? But what I did... it was viciously wrong, and I have no excuse, and I tell you now that I will never attempt to come up with one. When you are years older and you remind me what I did, for whatever reason that you remind me, know in this moment, Sati, that as long as I have my actual wits about me, I will never deny what I did, nor will I ever say that it was excusable."
Yasmina knew that what she was saying was probably too much for any 12-year-old girl to take in, especially a 12-year-old girl who'd been through as much as Sati had been through in the last 2 years of her young life. But these things needed to be said if they were ever to make the start they needed to make to repair their lives. Having said all that could be said, Yasmina waited. Good-hearted as she was, Sati did not leave her long in suspense. She said, "Mummy," and ran to her. Yasmina crushed the child to her and murmured, "Thank you." When Missa returned, Yasmina was upstairs with Sati and Rabia. They were lined up on the bed that Timothy would not be sleeping in for a very long time. They were doing absolutely nothing. Everything felt beyond their capacity. Missa stood in the doorway for a moment, observing them from the light shed dimly from a table lamp near to the bed. It came to Yasmina that her daughter looked uncertain, so she said to her in a murmur,
"You find us at the end of our resources."
Missa said anxiously,
"Mummy, is Gran—"
Rabia stirred. She'd had her arm over her eyes, but at Missa's voice she'd lowered it.
"Gran," Rabia announced, "has managed to survive worse than this."
And then, after a moment,
"Well, all right. Perhaps not worse, but I intend to muddle onward. What about you?"
She moved over on the bed and patted the spot she'd vacated. There seemed to be a long bout of breath-holding before Missa moved across the room and joined the rest of them. Rabia took her hand and pressed it to her cheek. Then she took Sati's hand and did the same. Sati, after a quick look to be certain it was acceptable, took Yasmina's. They simply sat and breathed. They were as one organism, really. At this moment, together they had the strength to be one person. Later, perhaps, they could be more. It must have been 10 minutes, Yasmina reckoned, before Missa spoke again. She said,
"He wants to wait. He says he can see what it's all been about. He says he'd like things to go his way eventually, but they can't go his way now. He says he's meant to build his business, and I'm meant to... whatever." "What did you tell him?" Yasmina asked. "I said I would..." "No."
Yasmina stopped her at once.
"I don't mean what did you tell him in reply to what he said to you. I mean what did you tell him about what happened in December in Ludlow?"
"The truth," she said.
Rabia said, "He wants to wait because of that, does he?"
"No, he says he wants to wait because it's the right thing for both of us just now."
"Is that what you think?"
Rabia asked her.
I don't much know what I think any longer, Gran.
Well, that makes two of us, Rabia told her.
Three, Yasmina added. And Sati made it four.
26th May. Victoria, London. It had taken the entire day, following Clover Freeman's suicide and Gary Ruddock's confession, to complete everything.